In the year 2018, our current sort of time scale, we've seen movements such as the hashtag MeToo movement. We've seen a variety of other aspects where certainly there have been general sort of social moves, as the Arab Social Spring, of course, a few years ago. What I'm going to start exploring today in this first session back after Reading Week and after we looked at the Vietnam War and the challenges that that was raising, certainly for America and indeed Britain, is this next interesting combination of what effectively all ties into sexual liberation, but kind of emerged together within the hind end of the 50s, certainly through the 60s and through the 70s, and arguably still continues in the present day in one way, shape or form. So why have we actually seen this particular growth, this sexual revolution developing in the second half of the 20th century? Well, according to most conventional accounts, you can try and you can test the reserve that British people have actually had about sex way back to the Victorian era. There was certainly a period within the Victorian times where the whole notion of patriarchy was very much the dominant ideology, that men were very much in charge, that women in the main were seen as breeders, housewives, or again, assistants to the male of the species. And certainly there were other issues relating to gay rights, which we'll go on to talk about as well. But broadly speaking, if you were to actually get a snapshot of what life was like in the 1950s, generally, sex in marriage was seen as okay, sex between unmarried teenagers was certainly not okay, and sex between men was illegal. That state of affairs, as I mentioned, goes back to the Victorian times and the moral panic that certainly emerged within the Victorian era, the Maine's Tribute, the writings of W.T. Stead, all of these issues and concerns that were being expressed about how sex is something that is unclean, not really talked about, should be suppressed and effectively submerged under society. And certainly the repression of sexual activity tends to often lead to other emergencies, as we'll see. But in the 1960s, what happened which really changed the game and developed this sexual revolution was the notion of premarital sex becoming more common, the notion that abortion and contraception were very much on demand, and also homosexuality becoming acceptable. As a result, Britain was never the same again. Now, again, that's probably too simplistic a picture. But in broad brush strokes, just as this particular opening slide opens up the alternative magazine Oz, using the satirical line of washing up powder, it kind of gets a message across, and it's something which we'll talk about in more detail in seminars. But it is true to say that the 1950s actually saw quite high levels of ignorance when it came to basic sexuality. How do we know this? Well, look at the numbers of illegitimate births, illegal abortions, shotgun marriages, and the disastrous relationships that we actually saw being portrayed in the new wave books and films of the time. All of these were issues. They were issues which raised people's concern about the sex lives of children. And obviously, you know, we don't see our parents as being sexual creatures, and they don't see it. And it's a whole range of issues that comes to the fore within that whole field. Many British children actually received no sex education whatsoever from their parents, and schools didn't provide any alternative because it wasn't seen as a subject for discussion. It was not something that people, polite people, the right kind of people, would actually talk about. But at the same time, clearly, as people were being born, people did seem to be having sex before marriage, and indeed sex outside of marriage during the war years. And contraception was available. The first family planning clinic that was established in the United Kingdom was opened by Dr. Marie Stopes at 61 Marlborough Road, North London, in March 1921. And Marie Stopes sold hundreds of thousands of advice manuals. As early as 1930, the Church of England actually voted to allow contraception, which made life a lot easier for women who didn't want large families. So for the first time, you were seeing the advocacy of condoms, prophylactics, natural rhythm methods, ways in which you would effectively control whether or not you wish to give birth or not, as the case may be. Sexual textbooks were also a thriving market. Love Without Fear, defined there and written by Eustace Chesser in 1941, actually sold 3 million copies by 1964. It wasn't a publicly available book, but it was available through mail order and through backstreet shops. So if you wanted to find out, as the title of Eustace Chesser's work there says, how to achieve sex happiness in marriage by the foremost authority on sex technique, you wouldn't be able to actually publicly publish it openly. It would need to be, again, via the underground routes and or possibly mail order. So again, there is this notion that it's not something which we would normally talk about. Many men actually also assumed that once they got married, they would have sex on demand, that the woman's role was passive. But by the 1950s and 1960s, those ideas were changing. Maybe because women had become more independent during the war years, and many had actually had affairs. Maybe also there was the general weakening of the church in society. That also possibly had an impact, thou shalt not commit adultery and so on. Or maybe it was also just the demands of a changing world and changing expectations with changing opportunities. The Marriage Guidance Council was actually formed in 1943, which when you think about it is quite significant because Britain is still very much at war then, and clearly there is a concern about how marriages are going to survive. If the soldiers at the front line are receiving the equivalent of Dear John letters, thank you, but I've fallen in love with somebody else, clearly it's not going to impact well on their morale. So maybe that's one of the reasons why it was seen as important that you establish an organisation to help support the institution of marriage. That's exactly what the Marriage Guidance Council was formed to do, to support marriages in trouble and to give guidance on sex. Important because, again, if marriages did fail, people in them had to soldier on because divorce itself was not easily available for the middle and working classes until 1949. You could get divorced, as indeed Wallis Simpson had been divorced in 1936. She was an American divorcee, which resulted in the abdication of the King of England at the time because he wanted to marry this divorcee. But if you were in the middle of working classes, unless you had an independently wealthy funding source to actually cover the costs of solicitors, lawyers and so on, it wasn't really an option. So divorce as such wasn't really available, certainly until at least 1949, and arguably remained very difficult to establish for a good 20 years after that. The major grounds for divorce: adultery and desertion. It wasn't actually until 20 years later, in 1969, that the idea of a guilty party was actually dropped, and all you needed to do was to provide proof of an irretrievable breakdown in the marriage in order to secure the divorce. So what have we actually got here in terms of people's personal habits and aspects with respect to that? Well, as we've said, in the 1950s, sex outside marriage certainly was happening, but it was still considered immoral by many and sinful by some. People's standards seem to have been quite high, but actually poll suggests that over half of adults indulged in sex before marriage. There were two types of sexual behaviour in society that were creating great anxiety. They were prostitution and homosexuality. In fact, during the preparations for the Festival of Britain, if you remember, that was back in week one, I showed you the slides of the South Bank and the development of the Festival of Britain, and the idea of establishing this celebration of good British culture and so on. Well, actually, the authorities were so worried about prostitutes pestering the tourists that they were effectively looking to drive them off the streets. Prostitutes were seen very much as a threat to social stability. And there were thousands of offences and convictions for street offences. Similarly, homosexuality also created a moral dilemma. Now, in April 1954, the government appointed a committee under Sir John Wolfenden, you see there, to examine the treatment of both prostitutes and homosexuals in society. It was seen that actually the Victorian notion of simply sweeping these problems, quote-unquote, under the carpet, wasn't really suitable for Britain as it was entering the second half of the 20th century. And so they decided to actually conduct an inquiry. Wolfenden was Vice-Chancellor of Reading University. He was a Christian who believed in the sanctity of marriage. But he also seems to have actually been quite uncomfortable with the actual words homosexual and prostitute. So what did he actually do when he spoke about homosexuals and prostitutes? He used a euphemism. He used Huntley and Palmers. It's not really necessarily the best way to actually employ, as the chairman of this particular investigation, somebody who can't even bring himself to say the words. But it kind of gives some indication of the sense of repression, the sense of concern, the sense of challenge that was seen at the time. Certainly, John Wolfenden looked like a man who reflected the moral majority. Very dangerous phrase, but nevertheless one that's frequently used by the tabloids even today, the moral majority. But Wolfenden was also increasingly concerned that his own son, Jeremy, was homosexual. He actually wrote to his son, Jeremy, on numerous occasions, but he made two key requests. First of all, he asked Jeremy to stay out of his way for the time of the investigation and the survey being carried out. He also asked him to wear less makeup. The Wolfenden Report was finally published in 1957, and the conclusions were as follows. The committee actually lamented what it perceived as the loosening of moral standards that had occurred in Britain since the Second World War. It also lamented the weakening of the family, or what it perceived as the weakening of the family, and what in essence they were very much arguing was the cornerstone of British society. They recommended that the laws on prostitution should be tightened up and penalties for prostitution increased. They also recommended that homosexuality should lose its criminal status where it was a private affair and carried out privately. Again, it was only 30 or 40 years earlier Oscar Wilde had been jailed for the crime of being homosexual. It was very much seen as something which was completely unacceptable and not present at all in British society. Effectively, what Wolfenden was suggesting was that there should be a principle that where sexual behaviour was public, the state could interfere, and where it was private, it couldn't or shouldn't. In actual fact, much of the content of the Wolfenden Report was ignored. The Sunday Times called it a pansies charter, and the Street Offences Act of 1959 drove prostitutes off the streets and into brothels or cheap hotels. So for homosexuals, as the law stands at the end of the 1950s, early 1960s, it amounted to a blackmailer's charter. Vulnerable men, like Alan Turing, of course, who actually had helpfully, successfully decoded the Enigma problem, vulnerable men who were trying to hide their leanings were open to extortion by anybody who wanted to out them. Now, culturally, the first British film to deal explicitly with homosexuality was Victim. This arrived in the wake of the public debate which followed the publication of the 1957 Wolfenden Report. For the lead actor, Dirk Bogart, who actually signed on to play the lead character after the first choice was actually declined, Victim was a very brave decision. it actually also tied in with rumours about Bogart's own sexuality and own potential homosexuality. The vast majority of folk, if you actually asked them at the time, would have viewed homosexuality as an illness, as a mental disorder, and in general, they would be perceived as something that was outside society, and the vast majority of folk would be hostile towards it. Although there were some upper middle class homosexuals, and indeed heterosexuals, who openly campaigned for change. But again, they were often seen very much as being part of the minority, or the eccentric brand of society, and so on. In 1958, 33 eminent political and cultural figures sent an open letter to the Times calling for a reform in the law. They included the philosopher Bertrand Russell, the historian A.J.P. Taylor, and the bishops of Birmingham and Exeter. The group itself went on to form the basis of the Homosexual Law Reform Society, tirelessly campaigning for change and pushing a succession of bills, all of which failed in Parliament. Because you're not going to actually be re-elected if you're seen by your possible electors as campaigning for something which you see as morally deviant. Despite the Wolfenden recommendations, again the notion of what happened in private should stay in private, the government should really only concern itself with what is public, the Reform Society and the great success of the film Victim, we were still seeing a situation in which homosexuality remained an imprisonable offence until 1967. So if you happened to be gay in Britain, you'd be sent to jail. The Sexual Offences Act of 1967 itself didn't make homosexuals equal, but it did decriminalise acts between consenting adults aged 21 or above. Cruising public spaces and cottaging remained offences. Scotland actually didn't change its stance towards homosexuality until 1980, and Northern Ireland waited until 1982 before there was a change in the law. So that's the situation that's occurring in Britain. Fairly repressed, fairly uptight, fairly concerned, you might well say. What's taking place across the Atlantic in the United States of America? Well, in the 1960s, there was a small established gay community in Greenwich Village, in New York City, which had its own gay bar, a place called the Stonewall. Men who visited the bar would be regularly harassed by the police. And on the 27th of June 1969, they fought back, resulting in what has gone down in history as the Stonewall Riots of 1969. This marks the beginning of what we now refer to as the Gay Liberation Front. The Gay Liberation Front developed in Britain in 1970. It campaigned for homosexuality to be recognised as a valid sexual orientation. A survey of the under 45s in 1969 by Geoffrey Gora found that only 12% of the population were tolerant of homosexuality, 24% were revolted, and 22% pitied homosexuals as people suffering from an illness. Now, despite that prejudice, and let's be clear, it is quite undeniably prejudice, gay liberation was very successful in spreading its message. Surveys at the time show that gay men in Britain and the United States amounted to about 3% of the male population, 3 in every 100, which is actually quite a small figure that actually makes the success of the movement in changing attitudes quite surprising. But in general, moral attitudes would remain pretty stable during the 1960s. With a quarter of all men and two-thirds of all women remaining virgins until they married, and only 1 in 3 boys and 1 in 4 girls approving of premarital sex. Very few people were promiscuous, and most sexual activity related to steady relationships. It's interesting that this is also coming about as a time where we see that the popular culture at the time is very much pushing the permissive society, a much more sexually open and free environment. Which again is an interesting sort of exercise to consider and work through. So why was this? If those are the figures, if we've actually got relatively few people necessarily wanting to change from the habits that their parents had actually developed and worked through, Why were we seeing this gradual growth of the liberation movement, and again, as we'll see in a few moments, the growth of the women's liberation movement as well? Well, arguably you can put the content for this towards the media. The mass media had actually expanded considerably, particularly in terms of television, which by the 1960s was very much the dominant overall media form. Sex would be discussed more openly, particularly in relation to the promiscuous minority. Most people, as I've noted, had steady relationships which actually led to marriage. And this so-called sexual revolution happened in the newspapers, with 77% of the population thinking that it actually got too much publicity. Now, up until the 1960s, feminists had concentrated on specific objectives such as the vote, such as equal rights in education and the workplace, the value of women as mothers, and so on. Clearly, the success of the suffragette movement in the 1920s had led to a certain form of equality in providing the opportunity for women of property to actually have the vote. Women had also mobilised in the Second World War and went out into the workplace to keep the war effort going at home. After the war, returning heroes needed jobs, and women were unceremoniously shoved back into the home. If you look at the fashion designers of the time, like Dior, they would promote this new look, certainly in the post-war 1950s period, which the likes of Audrey Hepburn and so on would probably be seen wearing and so on. It was designed to be a clothing which would suit the attitudes of the time. Advertisers, and again, let's face it, the whole success of a consumerist society is to sell things to people. Advertisers saw women primarily as shoppers. And teen magazines were also relentless in promoting marriage as the culmination of female success. If you look at women's magazines of the time in the 1950s and early 60s, the same themes are being revisited over and over. How to get a man, how to keep the man, how to create a perfect home, how to stay beautiful, how to raise children, and how the working wife could often be seen as a failing wife. Women would feel marginalised in industry, where, as we saw in the Kellogg's commercial a few weeks ago, they would type the letters, but they'd rarely dictate them. In politics, they might type the letters and they might make the tea, but they'd rarely make the speeches. In other words, femininity got in the way of business, and feminism got in the way of the class struggle. And so how did we actually move from here to here? Well, the women's liberation movement emerged out of student politics, primarily in 1968. Particularly key year, as I remind you, because of the Vietnam War, the riots that are taking place within that whole field, and the sense that this was a chance to also say, and another thing that's wrong with society, another thing that needs to be fixed and sorted through, is this. Much of the inspiration for the women's liberation movement actually came from the United States, where Women's Lib, as an organisation, sprang out of the civil rights movement, and where the National Organization of Women was actually set up in 1966. Initially, the mainstream media would trivialize or attempt to trivialize these issues, because on the one level you say, well, does this compare with rights on the basis of color, or rights on the basis of anti-war demonstrations and so on? The movement would be trivialized for protests such as the one we see here, the burning of their bras outside the Miss American pageant in 1968. Why? Well, who designed the bra? Howard Hawks. Why was the bra designed? A bra was designed as a fashion accessory to actually make women more appealing to men, and so on. It was seen very much as an instrument of male oppression. And so the burning of the bra was a symbolic gesture to effectively say, that's it, we've had enough, we're no longer actually going to stand for this anymore. It was indeed a serious organisation that was aiming for equality. And the first American National Women's Liberation Conference took place in 1968. Now, in the 1960s, public life and the workplace were still dominated by males. Films, in the main, had narratives that had male leads, they had male directors, it was the males who controlled television. Again, perfectly at liberty to say, so what else has actually changed? And given that we've had a very slight sea change over the last few years, it's taking a long time to actually change through this whole process. Females in film and television were usually portrayed as being stereotypes. Women who needed to be protected, women who needed to be rescued by the male protagonists. And in James Bond, women were primarily seen as window dressing. Does that effectively represent an accurate representation of women in general? Ah, but what about Wonder Woman, you might well say? Surely she emerged in the wartime period of the 1940s to 1950s. Well, yes, but she was also created by William Moulton, who also went on to create the lie detector test, hence the lasso of truth. And again, arguably, you've got another issue there in terms of how femininity had to be reclaimed and changed through that. And some of the lines that we see in terms of that, judge ourselves as people, women are enslaved by beauty standards, consumer con game, and so on. All kind of reflecting concerns that women actually had about the way they were being portrayed, what society was saying about them, how things were being developed and addressed, and so on. Even actually, two very liberated women at the time, in the TV series The Avengers, Kathy Gale, portrayed by Honor Blackburn, and Emma Peel, portrayed by Diana Rigg, were closely followed in the fashion pages. But even though both of these women were very much the equal of the male protagonist, John Steed, and we'll have a look at some clips in seminars to talk about this, on the other level, it was seen that the programme could actually be dismissed, just as Wonder Woman could be dismissed, because they were simply a surreal fantasy. So this wasn't a reality. This was simply a case of wish fulfillment, fantasy, and so on. Kathy Gale was represented as a widow, and Emma Peel, at the end of her two seasons with the Avengers, finally returned to her missing husband. So we have that interesting combination between the fantasy world of women, the dress of that sort of aspect, and what's happening in real society. Also, the growth of the counterculture emerges. And underground magazines such as Oz, the title itself is a play on the L. Frank Baum novel and classic Wizard of Oz that comes through there, Follow the Yellow Brick Road. It's got a drug reference that connects with that. It's nothing to do with Australia, in case you're thinking, oh, Oz, Australian. But underground magazines like Oz would give space to women, but that space would often be as sexual icons rather than actually promoting feminism. Many women still felt marginalised, certainly when it came to what they were doing on a day-to-day basis. And certainly in Britain, one of the key elements that developed with the establishment of the London Women's Liberation Workshop in 1969 was the publishing of newsletters such as Shrew, S-H-R-E-W, as in Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew. The problem of misrepresentation of women in the press, the promotion of female stereotypes, made the existence of publications like Shrew and other prominent feminist magazines such as Spare Rib, which was launched in 1972, all the more important. Those magazines not only allowed the women's liberation movement a platform for self-representation, but on the back of media headlines generated by direct action, they also reached a wider female audience. And feminist magazines would also provide alternatives to typical women's magazines of the time. You'd also see a shift in terms of what magazines were being developed, such as Cosmopolitan, Cosmo, and so on. In 1968, slide that we've actually reached there, sewing machinists at the Ford plants came out on strike. Again, the strike was based on A Source for Equal Pay, and there's a movie that was made about this about 2 or 3 years ago, as well we'll see. The strike was viewed as a success because the women managed to secure 95% of the rate that men were paid. So from that basis, even though they didn't have complete equality, they did receive 95% of the same payment as men were getting as well. Now, the very fact that these women were working class, clearly we haven't got the fantasy figures here. These are ordinary women who you might well see as your mother, grandmother, aunt, etc., sister, daughter, all connected with the public. And it actually sort of drew the attention of the press. The trade unions, who again had pretty much ignored women in general, also began to look at the plight of women a bit more seriously. And by 1969, the women's liberation movement was building up a network with around about 70 small groups that would meet throughout the country, often in each other's homes, and often they'd start discussing feminist issues and so on. Many of the members of those groups actually felt stifled by their roles in society that society was imposing upon them as being housewife or mother or housewife, and so on. And we still have a situation where men, in the main, still had the jobs, they still had the money, they still had the power. Women would marry at an average age of 22. They would be, in many cases, pressurised by the happy endings that were promised in women's magazines and romantic novels. But it wasn't what they actually hoped, and it wasn't fulfilling for many. For active women in careers, the pressure to become liberated sex objects as well was enormous. And to equal a male, some argued, a woman had to be equally sexually liberated. Actually, there's an argument that suggests that the pressure to be promiscuous, like the pressure of miniskirts and mascara, were simply new forms of oppression. The first Women's Liberation Movement conference in Britain was actually held in Oxford in 1970. And in 1970, the British Women's National Coordination Committee drew up four demands. Those demands were as follows. Number one, equal pay. Number two, free contraception, free abortion on demand. Number three, equal education and job opportunities. And number four, free 24-hour childcare. Those demands were printed on banners and on a petition handed to the then Prime Minister, who was Harold Wilson, on the 6th of March 1971, when 4,000 women marched through London on the movement's first International Women's Day march. And of course, as we approach the 6th of March, that's the reason we effectively sort of connect International Women's Day with that time in 1971, where there was the march of 4,000 women to hand in that petition for those four things: equal pay, free contraception, equal education, job opportunities, free 24-hour childcare. It's up to discussion in terms of how 50-odd years later, has that been achieved? Has that been developed? Are we still actually dealing with a situation where there are issues from that point of view? In 1970, the government passed the Equal Pay Act, which basically stated that women would receive the same pay for the same job as men. It took 5 years to be implemented. It was finally enacted in 1975 because employers needed to have time to consider the implications. And it wasn't actually beefed up again until 1983 to include comparable jobs with different job titles. So there was a get-out clause. If you actually had similar jobs but the job titles were different, you could also have differential pay. And the fact remained that in the 1970s and beyond, women were discriminated against in most areas of life. They were mostly trapped in low-pay, low-skilled jobs, with many challenges lying ahead. But there is an argument that the movement generally and gradually was bringing about significant change. A couple of those significant changes were the Sex Discrimination Act of 1975, which outlawed sexual discrimination in the workplace, and also in 1976, the Domestic Violence Act, which was passed enabling married or cohabiting women to obtain a court order which could prevent further violence and also provide a way of excluding her violent partner from the home. So progress is being made. Homosexuality is being decriminalised. Women have effectively been getting even equal rights. There are shifts in terms of what we're seeing. how we're relating to this whole notion of equality of the sexes and the genders and so on. But the question that actually is being addressed in terms of this module is, to what extent is this movement international? Is it revolutionary? How does it actually impinge on areas across the globe, etc.? And on the one level, you could say, well, of course it's international, because look, you've got International Women's Day taking place in London and in Melbourne, and it's crossing over that whole field. But then, is it also taking place in Iraq, in Iran, in China, and so on? Again, interesting debates in Africa, in certain parts and areas within that. How is this also plugging into the civil rights movement? How is it also plugging into the equal rights movement, the gay rights movement, and so on? Is it simply a case of, these protesters, they'll always protest about something? Is it a case of, ultimately, we've got some fundamental areas, such as striking for equal pay, and so on? Or are we still in a situation where, say, in the aftermath of the Weinstein system and so on, you still have a situation even now where mainstream media are still a little bit unsure about saying, well, actually, yes, we should support this. Let's see how we actually go to develop and enhance this. Again, these are questions which we'll go on to consider in seminars, together with some other examples of the material that's coming through, before we head off into more revolutionary aspects and that other element, which is to be considered next week, the question of immigration. Thanks for your time. Make sure you've signed the register, and I'll see you later.